But the fact is that upside in commodities is inevitable. It may or may not be imminent. And that's good enough for me. This, if it occurred, wouldn't be the first time I'd been 2 years early. The last time I was 2 years early was in 1998 in anticipation of 2000. And I have to say, being early for that market was way, way better than being late.
Welcome to WealthyN. I'm WealthyN founder Adam Taggart. Despite starting the year off with stunning price increases, many commodities and the share prices of the companies that produce and service them have been beaten down over the past 2 months. Many bruised resource investors are wondering if the worst is now over or if it's yet to come. And if you're one of those folks, I've got good news for you. Veteran hard asset investors Rick Rule and Brian London are both so excited by the future prospects of this sector that they pulled together an impromptu webinar this week to update their respective followers on why they think the current price action is a cyclical correction inside of a much larger secular bull market for commodities, meaning it's offering a chance to buy in at very attractive valuations before prices resume rising up to new highs. Rick and Brian asked me to moderate the discussion, and because I did, they've kindly agreed to make the footage of the full event available to the WealthyN audience. So let's get started watching it now. Welcome. We're here for a fun chat with two greats in the natural resources space. Of course, I'm referring to Rick Rule and Brian London. I'll introduce each one of them in just a second here. But we're here to talk about the future of commodities. And what's special about today's webinar is that Brian and London both follow the natural resources space very closely and are beginning to see things light up on their dashboards that say that the commodity space may be bottoming. I know they've got they both think that there's a sort of secular boom ahead for commodities that we might be close enough to that it may start making sense here to deploying some capital or at least start making sure you got your target shopping list in place. And they wanted to get this message to folks as quickly as possible. So as I said, I'm joined here by the great Rick Rule. I'm sure most people here don't need to have him introduced, but he's the president and CEO of Rule Investment Media. Rick, I was a little shocked, given how youthful you look, to realize that you have been investing in this space for nearly 50 years at this point. And I hope you don't mind me sharing that number with people, but that you've been investing in really everything inside the natural resources space, agriculture, alternative energy, forestry, oil and gas, mining and water. You're also highly involved in private placements as well. Just truly sort of, I hate to say it, but sort of an elder statesman in this space at this point. But anyways, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me back. It's going to be fun today.
It should be fun, especially because we're being joined by Brian London, who will be your panelist partner here. Brian is an excellent speaker, and I say that because he's the CEO and president of Jefferson Financial, which puts on the New Orleans Investment Conference every year, which is really the preeminent macroeconomic conference of the year. He's also the publisher and editor of Gold Newsletter, which covers a lot of precious metals mining stocks, but they also cover a lot of other resource stocks, as well as everything across the world of investing, from macroeconomics and geopolitical issues that ultimately affect every investor. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Adam. And I'm embarrassed to say, or dismayed to say, that I remember when Rick was the young buck in the industry. And older than me, old enough to be a mentor in the industry. But still, man, time flies, Rick.
They say in order to be a good old boy, it helps to be good. It isn't necessarily, you don't necessarily have to be any boy, a boy anymore, but you do have to get old. And so by forgetting to die, I've become a sage, Brian.
Forgetting to die. All right. Well, look, guys. You know, suffice it to say, there's a tremendous amount of experience and expertise represented by the two of you on this panel here. So if we can, let's just dive right into this. So what I want to talk with you about is the futures of commodities from here, as you see the sector at large. I mentioned briefly that I believe you guys see that we are approaching a secular boom cycle coming up at some point here. I'd love to confirm that with you and then really get into the details of where you guys see the most opportunity. But before we get started on that path, and Rick, why don't we start with you? Can you just give a little bit of context to what's been driving the price action in commodities this year? Because they've had a heck of a year. You know, they were the darlings the first couple of months, but the bloom has fallen off the rose relatively recently. So what's been driving all this?
I think very early on, the commodity sector was driven by the realization that the price levels witnessed during the COVID slowdown were simply too low, and that the levels of sustaining capital investment in the mining and oil and gas business were unable to keep pace with demand. You combine that with the recovery that we began to enjoy post-COVID, and demand for resources hit an air pocket with reduced supply, like happened in many other parts of the supply chain. You know, the commodities weren't the only sector that benefited from economic recovery. What I think was maybe unique to the commodity sector was the memory going back to the 70s that commodities are inflation sensitive, and the increasing awareness that people had of the ravages of inflation when the underlying CPI number was 8 and change and the return on their savings was paltry. So I think that we had a circumstance where we had a recovery. We had a recognition that commodities traditionally have performed fairly well during periods of inflation. And I think, too, that we had a growing realization among some sophisticated investors that we face fairly imminent supply shortages as a consequence, really, of decades of underinvestment in productive capacity and natural resources, a theme that I think that we'll return to again and again in this discussion.
Okay, so what, and then I'll come to you after I let Rick answer this, Brian. What has caused the bloom to come off the rose in the past couple of months here?
Directed to me, I'm sorry?
Yeah, let's have you have this first, Rick.
I think a couple things. One, I think some of the commodities, or at least the commodities equities, simply got ahead of themselves. They got some of the commodities equities, I would argue, got too expensive. An example would be the uranium juniors early in the year. They were forecasting $75 uranium in a $50 market. So they had to come off. But we also have gone into a market that is beginning to be starkly more aware of the possibility of recession. Recession in the near term takes no prisoners, including commodities. And we've been in a risk-off environment too, which is to say that the assets that have really attracted attention despite negative real interest rates have been intermediate term US bonds. In a risk-off environment, any sort of secondary or tertiary asset gets sold off. And there's probably no asset in the world that's more tertiary than a junior mining stock, particularly a junior mining stock that's active in some country that the investor can't pronounce. So I think in the very near term, I would say higher interest rates, declining debt and equity markets generally, the risk-off trade, and the fear of recession.
Okay. All right. Good list there. Brian, let me give you an opportunity to add on to anything that Rick just said there. Let me just say real briefly to folks watching two things. One, you should all be getting a replay video of this event after the event is over. Therefore, if you don't take, you know, every note that you want to take live here, or you have to leave halfway through to take your kid to soccer practice or whatnot, don't worry, you'll get a chance to watch the replay video. Also, we will be leaving some time, if possible, near the end of this for Q&A. So I'll start pulling any questions you guys have out of the chat window here. But don't fill it up quite just yet. I'll let you know when I'm ready to pull from it. All right, Brian, so coming back to you, Rick just sort of gave a good explanation of what drove, you know, first the big rises that we saw in price and commodities at the beginning of the year, and then why they've been cooling off here. Any additional color to add to that?
Yeah, I think one other aspect of all this is obviously the Fed and monetary policy. You know, starting off this year, we were anticipating the Fed's initial rate hikes due to the spike in inflation. And gold kind of counterintuitively responds well during Fed rate hikes and Fed rate hike programs. So gold actually started a rally of about a couple of weeks before the Fed's initial rate hike. And that was all going swimmingly. And then Putin decided to invade Ukraine. And then the metals really took off, you know, almost immediately upon that, in the type of a geopolitical response that we always recommend against people buying on, because it never lasts. And in fact, it didn't. So I think the Ukraine situation injected some noise in the signal that should have had a fairly smooth transition of gold rising as the Fed began rate hikes. But then we had the fear of recession really dominate the consensus view out there. And that's really put a thrown cold water on all of the markets, as we've seen in recent weeks. So I think that's been a big part of it. And the Fed's determination to hike rates, I don't think anyone gave Powell and company quite the credit that they've earned subsequently for really sticking with it and being so hawkish come what may. And they're bringing on a recession. I don't think a recession is imminent. I think it's already here. If at least from a technical standpoint, if the Atlanta Fed's GDP now readings are accurate, we've got the two successive quarters of negative growth that at least fits the technical definition of a recession. So I think we're mired in it right now. And the Fed brought it on, and you know, kudos to them. I didn't think they had the cojones, as it were, to actually do it, and they did it. So now they have to reap what they've sown. The question is, how long will they be able to stick with it? And you know, we can get to this later, but I don't think very much longer.
All right. And I do want to dig into that in a little bit when we talk about the role of a recession in depressing demand for commodities. We can explore how deep, how painful, how long you think the recession might be. We can also talk a little bit about the impact of a Fed pivot, if one indeed happens, as many people expect. But before we get there, two questions. First one is, I'm going to use a term that you used in promoting this webinar, Brian, which is that there's been sort of a washout in resource stocks over the past, since May. Is that washout over, or is it in process still, in your estimation?
I don't know that it's over, but I think it's probably close to being over. You know, I tell people, I don't know if this is the bottom, but it's a bottom. It's fairly close to it. You know, historically, or at least from a seasonality basis, the metals market typically, when seasonality does come into play, we've seen some extraordinary years recently where it didn't even come into play. But when it does, typically the market bottoms somewhere between mid-July and mid-August. Coincidentally, or maybe not coincidentally, Rick, who's the best timer out there of these cycles, scheduled his conference right in the middle of that range at the end of this month. So we'll see how that works out. But I think we're pretty close. You know, I am not jumping in head first, and I'm not recommending to my readers they jump in head first, but I am recommending that they pick up some of these companies, particularly companies that have established value, resources, large scale resources, some of them with economic supply to them. At these price levels, if the market only normalizes to, you know, returns to the median as far as valuations, you're talking about stocks that can go up 3, 4, 5 times from current levels, just if the market normalizes. We're not talking about any real significant rallies or overshoots or anything like that. So I think those represent a particular area of opportunity right now at current price levels.
Okay. And Rick, I'm coming to you with a couple of questions here, but one last one for you, Brian. Any counsel you would offer to folks watching this webinar right now who bought resource stocks earlier in the year and are kind of sitting on some losses here, maybe a couple of painful ones, and just wondering what to do about it?
Well, number one, I am in the same boat as you are. And that's the kind of the question that I have been getting in conferences I've been at and emails. You know, when is this is terrible? How long is this going to go on? And nobody knows, really. Nobody knows. And if somebody tells you that they know, precisely how much longer it's going to go on or what the precise path forward will be, then they're probably lying to you about something else as well. Nobody really knows, but you have to play, in some cases, your gut feelings. And right now, the situation is very reminiscent of, say, 1999 or 2000, that double bottom we had back then. There are a number of other factors that remind me of where that market went and how profitable that was over the succeeding 7, 8, even 11 years, depending on where you want to mark the peak. So my working thesis is that we're looking at that kind of a situation, multi-year bull run at some point. And a bull run like that has to start off with some kind of a soul-destroying bottom, which I think adequately or describes where we are right now.
Okay.
So hang in there, I guess, is the piece of counsel that I would offer.
Good, good. And to put some words in your mouth, which feel free to correct, but you know, if the fundamental outlook for the companies hasn't changed materially, you know, there haven't been poor, you know, mining results or whatever, you know, something that helps you, forces you to change your thesis, it's pretty much a hang in there, hold on and wait for the upcycle.
Yeah. And if you consider selling, consider who you will be selling to. You're going to be selling to somebody who's probably pretty smart on the other end of that trade, obviously has both cash and courage, and wonder whether you want to really, you know, who's going to be the smarter person in that transaction over the longer term.
All right. All right. Well said. All right. So Rick, coming back to you here, quickly too, I just want to put a pin in this for folks. Brian mentioned Rick's upcoming symposium, which is actually at the end of this month. So the timing probably couldn't be even better. Rick, I promise I'll give you a chance to tell folks a bit more about that symposium as we get into the discussion here, because I think it's a highly relevant way to take action based upon a lot of what we're going to be talking about here. So real quick, coming back to you, you just heard Brian's answers about sort of, you know, where we may be in this cycle of the washout. Do you have anything else to add to that before I toss some more questions at you?
Beginning by saying that I concur. Before we were taping, I gave you a Bernard Baruch quote. Bernard Baruch said, the only guy who ever bought at the bottom and sold at the top was a liar. It didn't happen. The idea that you're going to wait and bottom tick a market isn't going to happen. You need to inform a sense of value around a stock. And when you've formed a sense of value, then the price information becomes relevant. And if you can buy the stock at a price that you think is attractive, do it. If it goes lower, I hate to say it, but then the stock goes on sale, do it some more. Another comment there is, when you have an existing portfolio that's been marked down, don't become a slave to any one issue. The fact that a share sells for 30% less than you paid for it doesn't mean that it's the most deserving source of your cash. Sometimes you have to sell a stock that's down to buy a stock that you think has more upside. So certainly don't be afraid to do that. Buffett has a couple of wonderful tests that will scare the hell out of the listener. So let's go ahead and do it.
Let's do it.
The first is that you shouldn't buy any share in any company if you haven't done enough work that you wouldn't be delighted to see it fall 30% in price, so that you could employ the same intellectual capital to deploy more physical capital. Now, I'm embarrassed to say I've been tested by that thesis dozens of times in a 40-year career, but it ends up being true. The second thing he says is that remember that shares are fractional ownership of businesses. You shouldn't buy one share where you wouldn't be delighted if you had the means to buy the whole company at the same price. If you meet those two tests, you'll do fine in this market. If you don't meet these two tests, as Brian suggests, you might become the victim of an investor that is more financially and emotionally mature than you are.
All right, very well said. Okay, so I'm coming to the big question now about what's your thesis for a commodity boom from here. But before we get there, just one question for you, Rick, because you have so much experience in this sector. You know, obviously nobody could have predicted exactly Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But sort of that aside, is there anything that's happened this year in this sector that has caught you by surprise? Or is this all a movie you've seen before in one way, shape, or form?
Mostly I've seen it before. Mostly I've seen periods of underinvestment lead to supply shortages. What is becoming apparent to me now is the mistakes that society has allowed itself to make as a consequence of the policy of the big thinkers. The idea, as an example, that we were going to transition away from petroleum in some reasonable point in time. The idea in Germany that they could power the country with solar, where the sun doesn't shine. Don't forget, that's a northern country. You know, the sort of sunshine constrained, never mind the weather. The idea that this whole green agenda, while it doesn't have a lot to say for it, it involves more than narrative, or too much more than narrative, really surprises me. The American public's, part of the American public's buy-in of Mr. Biden's criticism of the big oil companies. He's told them to drill more, and he's also said that he's going to make them drill less. He's told them to invest more, and he's told them that their assets are going to be stranded assets 10 years from now. He has said lower the price at the pump when oil industry profits on average are 7 cents a gallon at the pump, and taxes are $1.34. The fact that a politician would deliberately mislead and lie doesn't surprise me at all. The extent to which those lies have obtained a global audience really, truly surprises me. The protests by Canadian truckers, by Belgian and Danish farmers, the beginnings of a reaction by working people to the idiocy of the elites is something that I would have expected would have been much more pronounced by now. These big thinkers are reducing your living standards, and they're proposing to do it in a much more dramatic fashion. And the fact that the diminishment of living standard in favor of narrative is as popular with as many people as it is, has been the big surprise to me.
Okay. Presumably that has an expiration date up at the point where people can't feed their families or, you know, stay warm enough during the winter, right? So who knows when we'll get to that point. But if we continue on this trajectory that you're talking about, it sounds like at some point we're going to hit it. All right. Well, look, that's a good segue then into the big question for this webinar here, which is, and we'll stick with you here, Rick, which is if you can, I'm sure many watchers have heard you on some interview in the past at some point, you know, giving your thesis back then. But as you look at the chessboard right now, why at this point do you think that we are approaching, you know, a boom in commodities? And maybe if you can also give it, I guess we'll get into the timing in a bit, but I'd love for you to give a sense when we talk about this, is this something that you think could be happening this year? Or are we talking a couple of years down the road? Like how near to this boom, the start of this boom could we be?
Well, first of all, I don't think we're near to the start of the boom. I think we're in it.
There we go.
People pay attention to equities markets, resource equities markets, as being down for 6 months, having been up for 36 months. When people say, Rick, when is gold going to move? What I say is, well, over 5 years, it's moved from 1,050 to 1,800. In other words, when does the move start? 5 years ago. We are in a cyclical decline in a secular bull market. It is not unlikely it could go further, but sometimes things get cheap enough. When you talk about a commodities bull market, Adam, I want to reiterate a discussion I had on your show, where I suggest that we're in two distinct commodity bull markets. The first is a precious metals market. We are in hiatus, hell, we're in decline with regards to the precious metal shares. But the truth is, if you believe in the underlying thesis around gold, which I absolutely believe in, the gold stocks aren't reasonably priced, but rather for the first time in my life, in my career, they're cheap. When will the market take effect? I don't know. I watched the same circumstance exactly happen in 1975. And again, as Brian suggests, in 2002, the stage was set, but the momentum investors left the trade. And so bargains were had by those who were astute enough to keep up to it. The other market, of course, is the industrial materials market. And we have seen what can happen when spot supply shortages hit that market. The oil quote going from, what, 20, 30 bucks. I'm not talking about the sub-zero market that was brief. Right. From 20 or 30 bucks to 135 bucks. The seaborne liquefied natural gas quote going from $6 a million BTU to now 36 million bucks, 36 bucks a million BTU in Europe. Certainly, we've seen the impact of supply shortages. And the market, or at least investors, particularly those on this call, need to understand that supply shortages are absolutely, positively inevitable. Inevitable as a consequence of systemic underinvestment in sustaining capital. Could they be delayed for 2 years or 3 years by recession? Yes, absolutely. Could commodity prices do well despite recession? Look back to the 1970s. The answer to that is inescapably yes. Is the bottom in? I don't know. Frankly, I personally don't care. When stuff is cheap enough, I deploy, and I'm doing that now.
Okay, so just to be clear, you are deploying capital right now?
I find myself embarrassingly, as a consequence of selling a couple pieces of real estate that I held for a very long time, having my portfolio well in excess of 40% cash and bullion. Ideally, I'd like to have 10% liquidity in my portfolio. So I'm trying to deploy with increasing eagerness. Don't get me wrong. I like cash. It helps me sleep nights and stay calm. But having in excess of 40% of your portfolio in cash when you think that a sector you know well is cheap, and when your yield on that cash absolutely positively without fail guarantees you a loss, there is some urgency to deploy, and I'm deploying now.
Okay. All right. Totally makes sense. Just want to tug on the thread here on supply shortages that you mentioned before. So yes, when you've been on my program, you have talked for many years about the fact that, you know, a big part of the resources investing thesis right now is really positioning for the chickens to come home to roost from decisions that were made a decade ago, longer than that, in terms of just starving CapEx of a lot of this sector, right? And what's interesting is the headlines right now, the focus are on the supply chain disruptions that were either caused by the pandemic or then by the Russian boycotts. I presume that those are, that's just kind of noise relative to the larger shortfalls for the CapEx underinvestment. I see you nodding as I'm saying this, but is that actually true? Is the big mega trend here really the inability to have invested in these industries?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the subsequent response shows us how tenuous the supply chain is. But there was no flex in the system. And it's important to note, if everybody's looking for Russia to kiss it all and make it better, if peace resumes, that the Russians have been among the worst offenders in terms of deferring sustaining capital investments,
yeah.
Which is to say that some of the hiatus in Russian shipments might have to do with Russia's inability to ship as much as they suggest that they might otherwise be able to do. But it's important to note that underinvestment in productive capacity and resources goes back decades, not quarters. It's important to know that all of the legislative protections put in place, as an example for the economy and for the environment, are also protections against prosperity in the context of the fact that they delay resource development. There have been other sectors of the economy that have either been more attractive or have been viewed as more attractive. And the consequence of that is that there has been a crowding out of natural resources in the economy for many, many, many years. But that's been exacerbated of late around ESG concerns around the environmental part of natural resources. One example would be the Resolution copper deposit in Arizona. 1.5% grade, as opposed to worldwide average mine grade of 0.5%, which is to say triple the worldwide grade. No conventional concept of political risk. It's in the United States, and it's in a copper mining town. Absolutely world-class scale, well over 1 billion tons, was discovered 25 or 26 years ago It has been in permitting for 21 years with no end in sight. The people that own would love to make the capital commitment. By the way, it's going to be a $7 or $8 billion capital commitment. It will take 5 or 6 years to build. But when I say decades of underinvestment in resources, I literally mean decades. If you look at the copper business, an example, everybody's looking to the electrification of the world, electric automobiles, all this kind of stuff. And yet productive capacity around copper, hell, Adam, it's older than me. Bingham Canyon's 160 yep. years old. Chuquicamata's 115 years old. The newcomer, Ertzberg, is what, 50 years old? Escondida, 40 years old? We need to replace major amounts of copper production. And there's one big new mine, two big new mines that have been brought on stream in the last 6 years. We need to be bringing on one a year. And we aren't doing anything like that. Similarly, in oil and gas, during the COVID period, it was estimated that the global energy industry, when the oil price was way low, was deferring new project and sustaining capital investments of about $3.5 billion a day, $1 trillion a year.
Wow.
Now, with oil and gas prices higher and with the chattering classes suggesting that, oh, well, maybe we could use a little more oil, the oil and gas industry is only deferring new project and sustaining capital investments of $1 billion a day. $365 billion in new project and sustaining capital investment is being deferred or delayed by the oil and gas business. This in a business where every day you pump a well, your business gets smaller. It's important to maintain, in terms of maintaining production, that you develop new fields, that you develop right. new infrastructure capabilities, that you recomplete wells, that you tune up, if that's the right phrase, water floods and gas floods. And worldwide, to the tune of $1 billion a day, we are underinvesting in productive capacity in the oil and gas business. There are no free lunches. That number has come home to bite, and it's going to continue to bite until it's addressed.
All right. And Brian, I'm coming to you, buddy. It's the problem being on a panel with Rick. The veins are just so rich, right?
It never shuts up.
Yeah. Well, but real quick. So, Rick, as I'm hearing you talking about this, I think of my favorite demotivational poster, which says government. If you don't like the problems we create, just wait till you get a load of our solutions, right? And so my question is, there's sort of two ways to change behavior, right? One is proactively, where you say, if I keep doing this, it's going to have a bad, ultimate outcome, and therefore I'm going to change my behavior now to avoid it. And then there's changing by pain, right? Which is, it just becomes too hard to continue the status quo. That's the person who doesn't change their diet until they've had the heart attack, right? As a nation, which way are we going to change here? Are we just going to have such great supply shortages that we finally, that pain causes us to say, look, all right, we're going to have to get rid of all the red tape and start actually being more pragmatic here? Or is there any hope that we could actually do something smarter sooner?
Experience tells me no hope politically. I think it was Churchill that said the United States has always done the right thing after they exhaust all the other opportunities.
Every single other possible option, exactly.
Yeah, and I think that people are beginning to wake up to the impact of higher energy prices. I think, too, people, at least savers, are beginning to wake up to the fact that banks are paying them 60 basis points in a currency that's deteriorating by 900 basis points. It's sort of a lousy spread.
Yep.
And my suspicion is, if enough people start worrying about their own lives, their own portfolios, that the aggregate of those actions will make some difference. But I expect that you'll see societal change when enough people get hurt badly enough that they threaten their elected politicians with an immediate vacation. That seems to be what changes things. I don't mean to sound cynical, but I've been watching the political process as it relates to investment for 49 years. And the consequence of that makes me pretty cynical.
Okay. All right. So looks like the pain is probably going to have to be dialed up before the changes we'd like to see start to happen. All right, Brian, now we are on you, my friend. All right, let's get to the fun part of this, which is, where do you see the biggest opportunities in the commodity space right now?
Well, I see opportunity across the board. I see some areas that perhaps have a better risk-reward dynamic associated with them. I agree with Rick, there's really two bull markets we're talking about in the broader commodity space. We're talking about precious metals, and by that I mean gold and silver purely. I look at the platinum and palladium as being more industrial. So looking at gold and silver, if you look at the macroeconomic picture, it's pretty strong, about the strongest I've ever seen. We will have the Fed at some point have to pivot, if not for the reasons of the recession or the stock market and the other bubbles it's created collapsing around it. At the very least, the really hard stop of the cost of servicing the federal debt. I've been publishing for really a couple of years now and kind of screaming from the mountaintops that if the Fed funds rate gets to right about where it is now or where it will be next month, the cost of servicing the debt are going to start approaching $1 trillion a year once they take a little bit of time to adjust. And that's unsustainable, I think, politically. And if they get to levels, the Fed funds rate gets to 4% or where the Fed funds futures market is predicting it right now, or 5 or 6% where a lot of pundits are predicting, then it gets absolutely unmanageable. So they just can't get there. At some point, they're going to have to be forced to pivot. And I think that's the basis for the bull market, the thesis I have for precious metals. The other one is industrial metals, particularly energy metals, particularly copper. You know, you can go across the board with uranium, you can talk about zinc, you can talk about nickel. All of them have compelling fundamentals, but copper, I think, is absolutely unavoidable and irresistible. If you look, if you get do away with everything associated with this new green energy, and we know that there's a lot of bull associated with that, but if you just ignore that, if you just look at primary demand growth, there's no way that current supply can address it. We have not only the ESG factor that's constrained development and capital investment over the last few years, but the last bull market, the big majors really got their egos bruised, and they took a lot of heat for buying assets in a way that would really make drunken sailors embarrassed. So they've gone too far to the other end of the spectrum now, and they sat on their hands for an awfully long time. It all adds up to supply constraints that are not only what you would normally expect in a commodity cycle, but much, much more extreme. And those supply constraints are now facing a demand curve in copper that is like nothing that commodity or perhaps any other commodity has ever seen before. So even if all of the green energy prognostications don't come about, just the primary demand says that over the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to have a spike in copper prices. And that's kind of time frame I'm looking at for that aspect of the bull market, the commodity bull market, copper in particular. And I look at the dive that copper's taken over the last month or two as really a gift horse.
All right, and Brian, let me just ask, in your outlook there, what role does the hopeful full reopening of China play in there too?
It has a big role, you know, in the 2000s bull market where a lot of people made an awful lot of money just riding the rising tide, and in specifically investing a lot of these junior mining stocks, hopefully some of the better ones that multiplied, you know, 4 or 5 times or more over during that period. The big driver back then was China. And China, of course, back then had double-digit rates of economic growth. And people look at it now and with China having half or a third as energetic of an economy as it did back then, but they forget that the Chinese economy is 5 times larger than it was back then. So yes, China is, I think, still a major part of the story and underappreciated part of the story. It's got a lot of problems. It's got a lot of overinvestment and issues that are going to come to rest, but it's still a major driver for the global economy. It's going to create, I think, the wiggles in the line going forward.
Okay. All right. I'm going to come to you now, Rick. Brian, when I come back to you, I'm going to ask you just for two or three names of stocks that you like for folks to check out here, just to give folks something tangible to do after the webinar here. Of course, we'll tell them also how to sign up for Rick's symposium, which is where you're going to get all the details. All right. But Rick, coming back to you, really sort of the same question, which is, you know, where do you see the most promising opportunity right now in this space? What's got you most excited? Brian just gave us the copper story.
Adam, I would say for the last 3 years, on your show in particular, I've been saying that investors need to overemphasize quality, that the price differentials between big stocks and small stocks weren't big enough that one should take the risk in small stocks. That's changing now. I'm seeing better and better and better valuations pop up in the mid caps and in the micro caps. And for investors who can take advantage of it, investors who can take risk, both psychologically and financially, my gut feeling is that in the junior sector, those companies who played chicken with the market, didn't raise money when they needed it because they thought the share price could go up and they could raise money less expensively in the future, are going to be between a rock and a hard place. My gut feeling is, maybe it's wishful thinking because I have cash to deploy, but my gut feeling is the next 12 to 18 months could be a very good place to play in the private placement markets. But I'm seeing stocks now that I hadn't visited for the last 2.5 years because they were hopelessly expensive. In one particular case, the stock has now fallen from 75 cents to 15 cents. I think it's worth more today selling for 15 cents than it was at 75 cents. So I certainly see that as an attractive opportunity. I see the GDX generally selling at the best multiple to free cash flow it's ever sold at today's gold price in my career as being attractive. But increasingly, I'm seeing value in the smaller end of the sector where I didn't see that value a year ago. You know, a year ago on your show, I think the only stock in the gold sector that I could really recommend with a straight face was, you know, Franco-Nevada and Wheaton Precious. These were not exactly aggressive recommendations. Now, there are probably 40 companies on my focus list that I think are buyable. There are probably 10 that aren't. So this is pretty attractive. I'm looking at smaller oil companies, which I haven't bothered with because Exxon was so cheap. I'm looking at one in particular now that is selling at less than 50% of net asset value to enterprise value, and is selling, by the way, at 1.5 times free cash flow. This is truly a silly, silly, silly number. So I'm seeing lots of opportunity. I see normally lots of opportunity in a market that wants to leg down. There is a reason why these opportunities are apparent. Somebody is going to have to suffer through a bit of volatility to get from here to the promised land. But the truth is that you buy goods when they're on sale, and goods are on sale.
All right. So two questions coming out of that. One is, if I heard you right, it's not that you think that the big majors are going to underperform going forward. You just think there's so much opportunity now on the lower end of the scale that wasn't there before that they just have a much higher potential return at this point in time, correct?
Yeah, I'm a microcap guy, Adam. You know, for 3 years, not being able to be in my sector because it was relatively overpriced was sort of boring. I was forced into conversations where there were a lot of other people who knew more about the conversation than I did. I'm delighted now to see the decimation among the juniors because it brings the discussion back into a sector that I'm very good at. It isn't necessarily, you could make the case with Exxon, given the performance over the last 3 years, that it's probably fully priced. But what's more important for this discussion is that there are $500 million companies that are, by any metric, substantially cheaper than Exxon. And you have to begin, you don't have to, but the prudent speculator naturally drifts to absolute value first, but relative value second. The fact that you have absolute value across the sector, but the relative value is better in the small cap place, means that I think it's going to be a very good sector, resources generally, for small cap investors, for stock pickers for the next 5 years. Okay, this isn't a market where you want to buy the whole market. It never has been. If you buy the length and breadth of the junior market, you absolutely, positively, without fail, will lose. You have to have the capability of separating the good from the bad from the ugly. But the good now are on sale.
Right. So build a basket of the good, basically. Yep. You're saying this is the perfect time to do that. All right. I know that some of these metrics change depending upon the type of business it is, but what are some of the key attributes you look for determining good value? Now, you mentioned free cash flow. I'm assuming that's probably one of them, or at least price to free cash flow. What other kind of metrics do you tend to look closely at?
The metrics depend on the style of the investor and the size of the company. I would look at an oil and gas exploration company very differently than I would look at Exxon. You know, at Exxon, I would look at margin. I'd look at return on capital employed. I'd look at return on equity. I'd look at the development pipeline. I would look at net asset value, which is to say the discounted net present value of their free cash flow 10 years out relative to their enterprise value. Smaller companies, you need to be, by definition, much less precise. With very small companies, ironically, despite the fact that they're regarded as asset-heavy businesses, they're actually intellectual property businesses. That's what exploration is all about. Mm-hmm. So with a small company, you're looking at people, and people. When you get done with those three criterion, then you need to look at the target size. For me personally, knowing that I'm taking huge risk in exploration, I want the possibility of a huge reward, which means that if a company is looking for a small project or a medium-sized project, I don't care. Anything that can go wrong with a medium-sized project can go wrong with a big project, but you can never make big money with a medium project. So I'm looking for target sizes in properties with in situ values of recoverable reserves and resources, likely exceeding $3 billion. I'm looking for a project that likely will be in the best cost quartile worldwide in terms of all-in sustaining costs. And I'm looking for a project that's going to deliver return on capital employed in the best quartile worldwide, which is, say, 25% plus return on capital employed at the forward commodities strip. So I'm looking for scale, and I'm looking for management. And beyond that, I'm looking for a company that has a business plan grounded in reality. A company where they can tell you what the most appropriate uses of shareholder funds are to increase shareholder value by answering unanswered questions. They can tell you that very specifically. And that can tell you, as a consequence of solving those problems, what the next problems to be solved are. It's interesting that if you go to Brian's conference or my conference more generally out in the investment world, it's embarrassing how many companies don't have an answer to what their business plan involving answering unanswered questions are, how they're going to optimize values. I had a wonderful discussion a couple days ago, and I'll name the company, Endeavor Mining, a gold mining company, where the CEO was actually lecturing me on the importance of companies thinking on a per share basis, saying it doesn't matter to you as a shareholder what the enterprise does. What matters is how well we do relative to the shares outstanding. In other words, what your share of our free cash flow per share is, all that kind of stuff. It's wonderful that after some years of penury, the industry is beginning to be rational.
All right, well, look, you're underscoring a really important part about natural resources investing, especially as you get into the smaller companies here, which is to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff, you really have to have some experience to do that. And the average investor, as they're going up the learning curve, they're generally much better served by sort of riding the coattails or tapping into the brain trust of experienced investors like you, like Brian, and like the many people you bring together at your symposium risks. So I want to give you a chance right now just to tell people about the upcoming symposium, what they can expect at it. Because from my take, that's where you go to really get both, not just the detailed context on how to invest, but you get a lot of, you know, the most promising targets that each of these analysts, are currently looking at.
What we've tried to do with our conference, and by the way, I need to tip my hat to Brian, a lot of our strategies were quite frankly stolen from his conference over time.
Hey, imitation's the greatest form of flattery.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We try and do a few things. The first is that we try to bring in place what I would call paradigm, which is to say the big thinker, the big picture guys. Now, obviously, my big picture view is stilted rather than other people's, but I'm appealing to my own audience. So I'm looking for the Jim Rickards, the Grant Williams, the Daniela DiMartino Booths, the Doug Caseys, the David Stockmans, people who can take the political economy and put it in context. And by the way, not the kind of context that you would see for free on CNBC or in the Wall Street Journal. Having done that, what I think is important is to explain people tactically how to go about implementing the strategies that are suggested by that narrative. So we try to bring the best gurus, the best analysts in the resource space that money can buy. If you believe A to be true, B to be true, and C to be true, what do you do about it and how? We think that's important. Most importantly, I think in that context for me, is for 30 years, we've had a feature in our conference called the Living Legends. In the Living Legends, we bring on stage five or six entrepreneurs who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from scratch. And we have them talk about how they did it and talk about how in the process of doing it, they learned what to do right and what to do wrong. And we asked them how those lessons have impacted how they invest and how those lessons should impact the way the audience invests. And this is absolutely critical. What becomes really, truly spectacular at my conference and in fact, Brian's conference is when you see these gurus and when you see these living legends and they're not speaking and they're wandering around the exhibit halls, take careful notes what companies they stand in front of and talk to. Take careful notes about who makes them smile or who gets a contemptuous snort. The idea for me that I'm following a Robert Friedland or a Bob Quartermain or a Ross Beaty around the exhibit hall, and I get to look firsthand at who they're talking to and listen to what questions they're asking, is absolutely invaluable. And I think that's what we've all missed with these virtual conferences. We've all missed some form of nonverbal communication, which is an important way to learn. It's important too, I think, at these conferences to take the educational message of the conference, take the description from an analyst as to how you might analyze a company, and then go on the exhibit floor and try it. You have this wonderful sort of coalition of information and how to, and a place to practice it where if you practice it correctly, you'll make a lot of money.
All right. So let's just give folks the details here real quickly, Rick. So that's coming up later this month. What are the dates?
July 26th through 29th in Boca Raton, Florida, for the first time in 30 years we've brought this conference to the U.S.
All right, great. And someone is asking here, so it sounds like it's going to be back in person this year for the first time since the pandemic. Will there also be a way to attend virtually as well?
We will do a virtual conference as well as a physical conference. The longtime conference goers, we polled them last year and they told me fairly unequivocally that I was going to do a live conference for them. So we're doing that. what I learned in the 2 years that we did virtual conferences is that I was able to attract people from 32 countries who wouldn't otherwise have been able to attend. So we will certainly do both.
It's great to hear you're doing a hybrid because there are pros and cons to both.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is, if you are able to take the time and able to get to Boca Raton, there is so much more information available organically at a live conference that you should do that. You, as an example, will not be able to follow Robert Friedland around my exhibit hall virtually. That is the function that we can do technically. You won't be able to go on a boat cruise on the Intercoastal Canal and rub shoulders with the exhibitors and drink fine bourbon with them. That just isn't something that you can do. So if you have the ability to attend physically, it's a better use of time. If you can't, I absolutely positively understand, and I would love you to attend virtually.
All right, great. And I've got a link to Rick's conference. I'll put it here in the chat section in just a second for folks that want to learn more.
I should say one other thing. In all of the investor education products that I've put on for the last 30 years, irrespective of what they were, they came with a full money back guarantee. If you come to Boca and you don't think that you got more than your money's worth, email me, preferably emailing me, telling me what I did wrong, but there's no requirement of that. And I'll send you your money back. The financial risk, not the time risk, the financial risk is mine.
I can't ask for any more than that. Hey, one last question. And then Brian, I do promise I'm coming back to you, buddy. You have retired, and I'm using that word extremely loosely because you seem busier than ever these days. I'm just curious, because you're now sort of your own free agent here, are you able to talk about things more differently at this symposium that maybe you could in years past?
I think it's fair to say that given the fact that Sprott ran, as an example, so much government money, that I can be a little more, I can discuss the roles that government might play in my investments more candidly than I might otherwise have done it. What I found interesting that I can do is I can tell other people what I'm doing with my money. I can tell people when I'm participating in a private placement, because it's not regarded as a solicitation, because I'm not soliciting, I'm not a broker. So in that sense, I'm much more free now. Both.
Right, you're allowed to open the kimono a lot wider than you were before.
Yeah, absolutely. It used to be everything I said almost had to be run through FINRA compliance, but I'm not a FINRA member anymore. I don't have to comply, which is very pleasant. And by the way, when I say I'm retired, Adam, I failed retirement. What I don't do now is anything I don't want to do. What I do is what I want to do. And I would urge everybody to adapt my measure of retirement.
Well, if we all could, you're definitely blazing a great trail for us. All right. So Brian, coming back to you here. And as I do, folks, we are bumping up against our hour time limit here. Real quick, though, if folks have any key questions they want to slip into the chat, now's the time to put them in there. If I can pull any in, I will. Brian, two things. One, I'll just ask you for one company, but is there a company that particularly stands out to you right now as one that would be worthwhile of folks going and exploring after this video? And then any reaction to everything Rick just said about sort of, you know, what you look for in a great buy in this space?
Yeah, and I think one of the key elements, the common themes here is that this market, the metals and mining market, particularly when you get into the junior mining stocks, it's an inefficient market. You can outwork other investors, and you should. And you can enjoy outsized returns, above average returns, by going to these conferences, by spending money, by spending time, subscribing to the best newsletters, et cetera. So you should do that. The opportunity is there, especially at a cyclical bottom like this, a long-term bottom where the tide should be rising and lifting all boats, and you can enjoy outsized returns by putting a little skull sweat into the sector and into trying to separate the wheat. The best conferences out there are Rick's and mine. I think you'll see people in the chat probably will come out there and support that, or vouch for that. There are some differences between Rick's conference and mine. Not a lot, but some subtle differences. You really have to go to them to kind of realize what they are. But if you go to both, you're going to be in good stead. You're going to be in a really good position. And at both events, you're going to enjoy the unmuzzled Rick Rule. If you thought he was before he retired, he can name names now and will. And he is the hardest working guy in show business, as I've said many years. He is on the floor. He is out there. He is talking to people, and he will give you his opinion, and it is invaluable. And it's one of the reasons why both he and I can offer these money back guarantees. If you didn't enjoy the conference, if you didn't get a reward from either event, then you just made a mistake and you walked in the wrong room and thought you were going somewhere else. They are invaluable. And I think the timing is especially conducive to invest in the sector. You had asked me.
And sorry, Brian, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm just going to put up a link here, everyone, to Brian's conference as well, too. So if you want to look at that, there's a link I just posted in the chat section to learn more about that. All right, sorry, back to you, Brian.
Yeah, and Rick's conference is coming up, so it is the more urgent thing. You really do need to go to it. It's going to be in a wonderful location this year as well. Now, you had asked me, and I wasn't expecting this, for some stock recommendations. I actually have a few here that, rather than just pinpoint one, Anacortes Mining, symbol XYZ on the Venture Exchange, will have drill results out over the next few weeks that I think will be surprising because they're essentially twinning some really spectacular holes from many years ago. And I think they're going to surprise the market. I do own that stock personally. Cassiar Gold is another one I own, symbol GLDC. Another one of those companies has over 1 million ounces, about 1.4 million ounces of fairly high grade open pittable gold in BC, and is on sale. I also like I-80 Gold. I think they're going to be a new mid-tier producer well on their way. I do not own that stock. They're specializing in Nevada, great management team. And High Gold Mining is one I just recommended in Gold Newsletter. I don't own that one either, but they've got just announced, I believe today, a resource update of about 1 million ounces of very high grade gold in BC. So I like that company at current levels as well.
Great. All right. Thank you. I know that's going to be highly appreciated by folks. Okay. Real quick, lightning round, just the last couple of minutes here. Have had a couple of questions here on if we go into a recession, if we go into disinflation, maybe even deflation over the next year, what's your guys' anticipated impact that would have on commodities? Is that, could that be influential enough to actually depress prices for a while? Brian, let's start with you. We'll go to Rick.
What would be depressing the prices? I'm sorry, Adam.
If we fell into sort of a serious recession from here, see strong disinflation, maybe even deflation.
Yeah, I think that's the speed bump that's most immediate. I don't think it would last that long. You know, the U.S. economy, the dynamism of the U.S. economy is such that you really have to work hard to screw it up. I think they've done that over the last couple of years. So I think the recession that we are in right now, I believe we're in, won't last that long before the Fed reverses, pivots, and stops its rate hike campaign. But it would depress prices in the near term. But I think that time frame between we realize that we're in a recession and the Fed pivoting will be relatively short, but I do think that would have a depressing effect on commodities and really all the financial assets.
Okay, and Rick, it seems like it's not enough of a concern for you to stop you from beginning to be deploying capital at this point in time.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, the search for perfection is a form of procrastination. an absolute bottom, I've never caught one in my life, and I've been trying for a very, very long time. When stuff is cheap enough, you deploy. That's the way it goes. If we have a severe synchronized global depression, will that depress commodity prices and commodity stocks? Yes, absolutely, positively. It may be that the strategy that I recommend is 3 years in paying off or 4 years in paying off. But the fact is that upside in commodities is inevitable. It may or may not be imminent. And that's good enough for me. this, if it occurred, wouldn't be the first time I'd been 2 years early. The last time I was 2 years early was in 1998 in anticipation of 2000. And I have to say, being early for that market was way, way better than being late.
Great, great, great experience to draw from. Okay, so we're going to wrap things up here, folks. Real quick, I will ask two last questions here. Very specific one, then a general one. Specific one, given the current gold-silver ratio, is it time to exchange gold for silver? Rick?
I don't understand why the gold-silver ratio is important. I know that'll get me a lot of hate, but the fact that silver is 16 times more abundant than the Earth's crust in gold doesn't go to utility. So I don't think that the gold-silver ratio, other than as a sort of a factoid that drives speculators, matters much. I like silver because of industrial applications. I like silver because it tends to outperform gold in real all-on bull markets. I like silver too because it's really out of favor. And I particularly like silver stocks because there aren't very many of them. Mm-hmm. If the generalist money comes into silver, like Doug Casey says, there isn't enough market cap to hold the money. I've seen it happen twice before. It's an awful lot of fun. You know, it's an awful lot of fun. But I don't see the question in the context of the gold-silver ratio, because I personally don't see the validity of the gold-silver ratio as an investment criterion.
Got it. Let me re-ask the question then, and just a short answer here. Is silver more on sale than gold at this moment in time?
Yes, I believe it is.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And silver has always outperformed gold in a monetarily based bull market, which I believe we're entering. So I do think silver will outperform gold. I do like silver, but the gold-silver ratio has never had any use to me as a timing mechanism. It gets to extremes, and then you think it's the time to buy, and then it gets extremer. And it's never worked from a timing. It's just a relative valuation kind of a thing. You need to own both, in other words, in my view.
Yep. Okay, great. And then I'll just take super short answers on this last question, but they're wondering if you guys, either of you, use technical analysis in your analysis of the sector, or are you more just pure fundamentals guys?
I don't think technical analysis works too well for junior mining stocks because there are too many individual factors that can affect that. But I do, as far as the metals, gold and silver tend to be more cyclical in terms of their stochastics than a lot of other markets like oil, for example. So I do like the 14-week stochastic for gold and silver to try and outline times of over or under valuation. And we cover those in Gold Newsletter on a regular basis.
Great. Rick, any parting words on that topic?
I'm a credit analyst, so I'm sort of a bottoms-up fundamental guy. I have great access to the work of Sprott's technical analyst, Paul Wong, which I follow, as Brian would suggest, in the context of metals markets for timing. But the truth is, if I think something is cheap, I ignore all the technical indicators and I buy it based on fundamentals. Simultaneously, you know, if you know, the market is sort of rocking and rolling and the chart is progressing rapidly from lower left to upper right, but I think stuff's getting too expensive, I don't let the chart tell me what to do with my bank account. I do some selling.
Okay, great. All right. Sorry, folks, I'm going to have to enforce the time limit here. I know many of you would love for these gentlemen to continue talking for several more hours. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the time and the expertise you've given folks here today. Last question for each of you. We'll start with you, Rick. For folks that would, obviously, they should go check out your symposium. We put a link there in the chat, folks. But beyond that, if folks want to follow you and your work, what should they do?
Go to my website, Rule Investment Media. As incentive, if you enter your natural resource stocks, I personally will rank them 1 to 10 and comment on those issues where I think my comments might have some value. Note that I'm swamped with rankings, so it might take 10 or 12 days to get your rankings back. Note too that in retirement, I'm starting a bank. And if you want to hear about a real old-fashioned bank, one with money in it, in the question and comment section at Rule Investment Media, write bank. Further, I can tell people what I'm doing in the private placement space now because I'm not a broker. I'm not compensated. So I'm not soliciting. So if you're an accredited investor and you care about where I'm putting my own money, in the question and comment section at Rule Investment Media, write placements. That's ranking bank placements, ruleinvestmentmedia.com. And I would love to see you all in Boca Raton.
Fantastic. All right. And Brian, for you?
Yeah, very simply, goldnewsletter.com and neworleansinvestment.com. And I saw somebody asked where they can get some information on the sector. We do have an investor's guide to gold and silver that is comprehensive and objective. I not only recommend the New Orleans Investment Conference in that report, but also Rick's Investment Conference in that report. And I will be there at Rick's event. So I'll also be walking around on the floor there when Rick isn't putting me to work. And Rick, you are putting me to work. I keep getting new responsibilities there. So
Albert's putting you to work, not me.
Yes, yes, he is. Okay, let's spread the blame. But please come up to me and say hi.
All right. Well, gentlemen, we'll leave it at that. Thanks so much. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate you joining us on such short notice.
It's fun, anytime. I hope you enjoyed this discussion by two of the greatest resource investors around. If you did, be sure to check out Rick's symposium being held on July 26th through 29th. To learn more, as well as register for the event, just go to wealthion.com/rulesymposium. I'll put a link to that in the description below this video. Also, it's always a good idea to benefit from professional help in determining how to prudently add exposure to resource stocks in your portfolio, like which ones to buy, how many should you own, what type of accounts to own them in, how to smartly hedge them, etc. So get the advice of a professional financial advisor who has experience investing in these kind of assets, because not all do. If you're having trouble finding one or would like a second opinion from a knowledgeable one, schedule a free, no commitment, no strings attached personal consultation with one of the financial advisors that Wealthion endorses. Just fill out the short form at wealthion.com and we'll help you set one up. And last, if you enjoy getting access to events like this, please help support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below if you haven't already, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Thanks for doing that, and thanks so much for watching.